Good morning. My name is Tom Wessels, and I'll be the moderator for this final session in the 2019 Monadnock Summer Lyceum. And to start, I would just like to really thank again musicians for the fine performance they've done today. They're the Mary Pipers. And I'd also like to thank Peterborough's Mount Holyoke Book Club, which has really generously supported today's event. And I'd also like to thank Eastview Flowers of Harrisville for the wonderful arrangements they have around the room. The Lyceum has been around for many, many decades, bringing in outstanding and world-class speakers to the Monadnock region to serve as catalysts to inform, engage, and inspire active citizenry on local, national, and global issues. And I think you'll find that today's speaker fits right into that mode. There are glass containers in the back and also in the parish hall where you can go to after this talk. And I encourage you to donate to this really worthy cause of what the Lyceum does. Lorette's talk will also be rebroadcast on local radio stations. So it is my great pleasure to introduce Dr. Lorette Savoy. She is the David B. Truman Professor of Environmental Studies at Mount Holyoke. And Lorette is also, by training, a geologist. But she's different from any other geologist I've ever met. Most of the other geologists that I have met are so focused on geology, they don't have much bandwidth for anything else. Well, that is not the case with Lorette. Lorette is truly a transdisciplinary scholar. She interweaves her knowledge of geology, landscape, cultural history, how land and people both influence each other, and then woven all throughout that is the often untold story of race and how that plays in this whole dynamic story that needs to be told and retold. Her scholarship is so acknowledged that her essays and books are widely read. Her most recent book, Trace, is a winner of numerous book awards. I'm not going to even list them as there's so many, but you can go to her website if you want to find those, and I encourage you to do that. And her scholarship has also garnered many fellowships. Most recently, she had a very prestigious Andrew Carnegie Fellowship, which allowed her to take a one-year leave of absence from Mount Holyoke to work on a forthcoming book, which I'm sure she's going to probably get into today, as well as talking a bit about Trace. Now, Lorette is not just an incredibly reflective transdisciplinary scholar, she's also a beloved teacher. I know this because I've sat in on her classes and I have watched sort of the admiration, even adoration, that her students at Mount Holyoke have for her. And actually, one of my former grad students at Antioch happened to be a student of Lorette's and really speaks very, very highly of Lorette. And it's not, it's sort of, to me, just perfectly normal that Lorette would be seen as such a beloved teacher because she is a person's person. She is warm, she's gracious, she's giving, she is joyous, and she just has this big heart. And in her book, Trace, she writes about herself as a young child growing up out west, and that's where she really fell in love with these arid western landscapes with huge expansive skies and very rugged geological landscapes. And I know that that young child still resides within Lorette, because whenever we're out in the field together, Lorette becomes gleeful and wide-eyed and just sort of awe-inspired. So that still remains within her. Now, I don't want to put her on a pedestal. Matter of fact, Lorette would not feel comfortable. I'm not sure she's going to feel comfortable up there, but in any case, that's where she's going to have to go in just about another 30 seconds. So I just wanted you to know she's also a very normal person. I mentioned two things that have probably never come up in any introduction before. But if you ever need to put a trivia team together and you want a master of TV trivia, well, Lorette is the person to go to, believe me. And if you're ever in a game room that has a foosball table, I suggest you walk as far away from it as you can, because if you get involved with Lorette in a game of foosball, she is lightning fast, and you will be demolished before you even know what's happening. I can say this from personal experience. So in any case, please join me in giving a very, very warm welcome to a good friend of mine, Lorette Savoy.
Good morning, good day. I should say that I didn't realize I needed to have tissues before I even started. So please forgive me for a second. Tears of joy as well as embarrassment. I'm honored, truly honored, to be part of the Monadnock Summer Lyceum. And I'm honored to speak in this historic church. And often when I give a talk, two lines from Walt Whitman's Leaves of Grass come to mind, and they've come to mind here. And perhaps you know them. The untold want. The untold want by life and land, ne'er granted. Now, voyager, sail thou forth to seek and find. Every place I visit, every talk or reading I give, feels like a voyage of discovery because of the people I meet and the dialogues we engage in, and also because of the great, beautiful music we often hear, as we did this morning with the recorders, which brought back memories. I got my first recorder when I was 8 years old, and I still have it. So I'm deeply grateful to Susan Copley for inviting me, and to Mary Valier Kaplan, Helen Bickford, and to everyone here who has organized this forum. The Lyceum's mission to inform, to engage, and to inspire is so crucial. I'd also like to thank Peter Burroughs Mount Holyoke Book Club. Thank you. And of course, my gratitude goes as well to my dear friend, Tom Wessels, a forensic ecologist extraordinaire, an amazing reader of landscapes, and a very wise man. And I won't say anything to embarrass you. Okay? But believe me, there are some things. Okay. And of course, I thank each of you, each and every one of you, for welcoming me here this morning. I come from a family that was silenced as well as silent. I was born to parents who are already well into middle age, and they had come into the world before moving pictures talked, before teamsters drove only horseless trucks, before the Iceman had to find a new profession. And they had lived with elders who could recall life before the Civil War, their memories lit by lantern light. Although nearly palpable, their past never spoke to me. My father died long before I had the questions, and in response to them, my mother always asked, "Why do you want to know?" It wasn't until decades after my father's death that I learned that he was a writer whose novel on racial hatred and passing, titled Alien Land, had been published to some fanfare by the big New York press at that time, E.P. Dutton. Dutton had him under contract for at least two other books, but Dutton canceled his contract on reading a draft of the would-be second novel about a Negro artist fighting against segregation in the nation's capital and wondering if communism might be an answer. My father found himself blacklisted, and when I came along far more than a decade later, this bitter, angry man did not write, and he often did not speak. So silence was easy for me to learn, and I've often wondered how much the deep unspoken hunger and need of a parent can touch a child, even marking a path for her to follow. My book Trace began in my struggle to answer, or at least come to terms with, questions that long haunted me. Questions like these, and I wonder if maybe they've haunted you as well. If each of our lives is an instant, a single instant, like a camera shutter opening and closing, what can we make of our lives, of our place in the world, the latent image that we have for that instant? And then, over time and space, what do generations of instants mean? The questions became a book, and the book grew to become a mosaic of personal journeys and historical inquiry that crossed the continent as well as time, exploring how this nation's still unfolding history has marked this land, this society, and me as a person. From twisted terrain within the San Andreas Fault Zone and the north rim of the Grand Canyon to a South Carolina plantation. From an island in Lake Superior to Indian territory and black towns in Oklahoma. From national parks to burial grounds to the names this land wears and the origins of those names. And from the U.S.-Mexico border to the U.S. Capitol. In all, Trace counters some of our oldest and most damaging silences by revealing often unrecognized ties, such as the siting of the nation's capital and the economic motives of slavery. None of these links is coincidental. Too few appear in public history, yet they all touch us. What I'd like to do is offer the prologue to the book and excerpts of two chapters, two examples of the marks of the history of this country and this continent, and marks of the place of race in this land. And I really look forward to our conversation afterward. I hope it's not just answer-response, but more of a give and take. So thank you again. And here is Trace. Prologue, Thoughts on a Frozen Pond. And let me preface this by, before I dive in, that when I've read this in, let's say, Southern California or Arizona, or we can think of, you know where I'm going. they think I'm nuts. But I think you might understand. Thoughts on a Frozen Pond. In the dead of winter, I like to walk on water, held above liquid depths of the nearby lake by a vast frozen plain. This ice demands respect. I look again, listen again, attentive to any crack or yielding to my weight. When the surface is more solid than a hardwood dance floor and much thicker, I venture far. Even then, I hear the gloop, a distant lurp, a muffled bloosh. Water undulates beneath ice and me. Sunlight appears to emanate from above and below on cloudless February days, rain through the crystalline lattice underfoot. With my eyes but inches from the surface, any sense of depth, of refracted distance, yields to a sense of motion arrested. Air bubbles halt in mid-ascent. White oak leaves descend as if on invisible steps, suspended for one season above the lake bottom. The recent past lies beneath me in these marcescent leaves, plucked and blown here by January's heavy winds. Inches away, they are out of reach, because I kneel within the next stratum. Thoughts of time's passage always come to mind on such walks, thoughts of how memory of any form becomes inscribed in the land. The hills surrounding this lake and my home are worn remains of long vanished mountains. Glacial debris from the last ice age produces a rock crop in my garden each and every spring. And stone walls that 2 centuries ago bordered fields and pastures now thread the dark heart of forests. Lauren Isley wrote in The Immense Journey that human beings are denied the dimension of time, so rooted are we in our particular now. We cannot in person step backward or forward from our circumscribed pinpoints. I cannot touch a leaf encased in ice, nor can I feel the calloused hands that once stacked these walls. Yet we make our lives among the relics and ruins of former times and former worlds. And each of us is, too, a landscape inscribed by memory and by loss. I've long felt estranged from time and place, uncertain of where home lies. My skin, my eyes, my hair recall the blood of 3 continents as the paths of ancestors, free and enslaved Africans, yet also colonists from Europe and peoples indigenous to this land converge within me. But I've known little of them or their paths to my present. Though I've tracked long bygone moments on this continent from rocks and fossils, those remnants of deep time, the traces of a more intimate lineal past have seemed hidden and lost. Yet to live in this country is to be marked by its still unfolding history, life marks that are seen as well as unseen. From my circumscribed pinpoint, I must try to trace what has marked me. The way traverses many forms of memory and silence of a people as well as a single person. And because our lives take place among the shadows of unnumbered years, the journey crosses America and time. Come with me. We may find that home lies in remembering, in piecing together the fragments left, and in reconciling what it means to inhabit terrains of memory and to be one. Trace, noun, a way or path, a course of action, footprint or track, vestige of a former presence, an impression, minute amount, life mark. Trace, verb, to make one's way, to pace or step, to travel through, to discern, to mark or draw, to follow tracks or footprints, to pursue and discover. So now I'd like to turn, and I have to tell you, I had a very difficult time trying to decide, well, should I talk about the U.S.-Mexico border, because so much is in the news today, or the nation's capital with the current administration? Should I talk about what? And so I finally decided on excerpts from two selections. And one of them begins with my asking you a question. Why does this country wear the names it does? And why does naming matter? What I'd like to do is just read excerpts from this chapter that ties a child's love of names to the weight of naming that often goes unexplored. And while the chapter does consider indigenous place naming and practices from many tribal peoples, I'm really going to focus on some of what was appropriated and imposed. So this is from the chapter, What's in a Name? Give me a story, and I'll give you one in return. Anyone passing our yard might think the solitary child played with an imaginary friend. She'd twirl in place, arms outstretched, eyes closed, each turn bringing a new word spoken with care. Sequoia, Shenandoah, Cheyenne, Susquehanna, Mojave, Yosemite, Wyoming. The words were names that rolled off her tongue. She'd stop, then spin the other way. Potomac, Chesapeake, Narragansett, Appomattox, Chattanooga, Monadnock. Once given breath, the names incanted spells, the turns crossing all distance between place and child. These were not turns of fancy, but a melding of sound and earth in her, in my, mind's eye and ear. Much as the evening shadows overtook the house edge and then approached and included me. To her, soundings touched contours of mysterious stories that could be plumbed if asked. Give me a story, and I'll give you one in return. Walt Whitman wrote, "Names are magic. One word can pour a flood through the soul." Had I, at the age of 6, understood these words, I would have counted Walt friend. Word moments could blaze with an intensity that seemed to concentrate all life. I placed myself by the compass of places sung aloud. That I hadn't yet set foot in most mattered little. There are other ways to travel to them. Once the continent wore no names, having no need for them, the languages of water, ice, and wind prevailed. Yet one can say Oklahoma or Yellowstone or Badlands without thinking, so embedded are they in American vocabulary. It may be a commonplace to consider place names as givens, distinguishing one piece of terrain from another. But to think this is to see a reflecting surface and not what lies beneath. I was born in the homeland of the Ohlone, which Spain claimed as part of what they called Alta California. My parents and I lived at first in a city by a bay named for St. Francis of Assisi. We then moved south to another city, grown around a river now confined within a concrete channel. That settlement was called El Pueblo de la Reina de Los Angeles de la Porciúncula, L.A. And one of the mountains in the range west of the city came to be known as niggerhead. Then we crossed the continent to what had been part of the Piscataway and Powhatan chiefdoms and claimed by Great Britain. We settled in a capital city named to honor the first president of the new American Republic. Yet few of the official names of these places, east or west, arose from the land itself. I now live, as we do, in New England, a half hour's drive from New Hampshire. On road trips south, I pass through New York and New Jersey. And there are many other new places, New London's, New Boston's, New Brunswick, and Nova Scotia. Names appear again and again. Cambridge, Bristol, Portsmouth, Newport, Plymouth, more, each having found at least two homes in the British colonies. In the Chesapeake Bay area that was my paternal ancestor's home, official names paid homage to monarchs whose patronage voyagers either enjoyed or sought. Virginia for a virgin queen, Elizabeth. Jamestown and James, settlement and river, remembering a king. Terra Marie, Maryland, acknowledging another queen, Henrietta, wife to Charles, son of James. Then there are the Syracuses, the Troys, the Athens, the Romes, the Alexandrias, and Philadelphias scattered across American maps to recall an older, old world. Other names spread westward too, with Anglo-American settlers after the American Revolution, and they left the land, as H.L. Mencken put it, bespattered with Washingtons, Lafayettes, Jeffersons, and Jacksons, then Columbuses, Columbias, Madisons, and later Lincolns joined them. Colonial tugs of war left remnants in name clusters born of other languages too. I hear Dutch echoes on every trip by New York. Haarlem or Haarlem, Yonkers for Yonkers, De Vouvrie, the Bowery, streets named Breedvee for Broadway, Duval, Wall Street, Nassau, Flushing, Staten, the Bronx, and to the north, Poughkeepsie and Peekskill, and across the Hudson River, Hoboken and Hackensack. And then there's Brooklyn. Brooklyn, meaning broken land, a nod to Long Island's glacial debris. And I also hear lasting marks of Spain, California, Florida, Nuevo Mexico, Santa Fe, San Francisco, Trinidad, Santa Cruz, Los Angeles, and Las Vegas, meaning the Oasis Meadows. An aside, if I may insert that, if anyone does go to Las Vegas, try to find the middle of the city where the wells are, the wells that drew out the groundwater that drowned or that dried, desiccated that Oasis Meadow. You can see well casings that began at the floor or ground level that now are as high as the balcony here. Water tapped from the Oasis Meadows that Las Vegas once was. But there are other names: Sierra Nevada, the Snowy Range, Rio Grande del Norte, the Great River of the North, Colorado, Mud Red River. And then there are words like canyon, mesa, arroyo, playa, terms for dry lands that the English language did not know. Names encode meaning and memory. And I can understand the impulse to place the linguistic familiar about oneself, because in stapling down small created certainties, an overlaying geography of home, could then orient and transform a vast unknown to a knowable new chance. Naming and mapping would work as twin projects in the courses of empire, as semantic redefining fit a design that made sense to the ambitions of those men from Europe who made landfall after landfall. Their linguistic claiming overprinted and appropriated older names, other views already there. Colonial maps and place names reorganize space on a slate that was made blank by drawing borders, by coding what and whom lay inside or out, by erasing. The project of illuminating terra incognita's darkness made certain ways of inhabiting and relating to this place called America natural. It made particular points of view normal. In their placemaking, these newcomers not only set out to possess territory on the ground, they also lay claim to territory of the mind and memory, to the future and the past. And the people who were already there, Powhatan, Wampanoag, and countless others who now were discovered but still not seen, could and did look back. And here lies the paradox, or one of many. To become oriented, to find their way and fill their maps, venturers from Europe needed native people's knowledge of the land. Maps and names would then obscure that knowledge from its context as indigenous peoples themselves were removed from the land. A pot spilled. Perceptions and names spread inland across the Atlantic seaboard, up from Mexico and the Caribbean, up from and down from Canada, covering older names and ideas. Names come into view, but sink from sight. Names metamorphose. I look for the names rooted in Native America. And I look too for visions originating with newcomers from other continents other than Europe. Because what I seek are the linguistic seeds of my own presence. Native place names, or the names of tribal people living in those places, began to appear on 16th and 17th century European maps inland of the Atlantic coast. Or it might be better to say that explorers and colonists transcribed into familiar symbols what they heard. Indigenous sounds twisted on European, then Anglo-American tongues. Words and phrases were often reshaped with little sense of original use or context. Maps and journals then carried forward clipped words, simplified renderings, and transliterated sounds. Mutating steps could result in an English version of a French interpretation of an indigenous word that ended up as Wisconsin. In misreading hand-drawn maps, the engravers and map makers in Europe created more errors. One letter changed, once formalized in print, could make a name of great meaning meaningless. More than half of the United States names originated in some form from indigenous languages. Some began as records of tribal peoples encountered, either what they called themselves or what others called them. Dakota, Illini, Kanza, Ute. Some state names refer to specific elements of the landscape. Massachusetts to the Wampanoag means place of the foothills. but Puritan settlers used it for a bay and their colony. Coictiqui, the long river, became Connecticut. And there is the convoluted origin of the name Wisconsin. According to one source, the French voyagers Joliet and Marquette heard and recorded Meskoutsin or Meskoutsing in 1673 for a river flowing west to the continental interior. But Meskoutsing became Wisconsin or Wisconsink on later maps, and finally Wisconsin in English. And native words for aspects of waterways or of names of people living by them also persist, even if in altered forms. Potomac, Rappahannock, Susquehanna, Merrimack, Penobscot, Connecticut, Ohio, Wabash, Missouri, Mississippi, Chesapeake, and all but one of the Great Lakes. A shallow braided stream crossing the plains was called Nithbathka in one native language. Ni for river and Nithbathka for its spreading flatness. Frenchmen in the 1700s translated this name to Rivière Plate, but they spelled it P-L-A-T-T-E. These waters, the Platte River, became the lifeline of the Oregon Trail. And from Nithbathka came the name of one of the states through which the river flows, Nebraska. In my mind, though, Oregon and Wyoming offer the most telling examples of how far out of linguistic, cultural, and geographic context American place naming could reach. The Oregon story favored by most began with a coincidence of mistakes on a 1715 map, an old legend that hadn't died, and liberties taken by explorer promoters who claimed and advertised far more than they knew. First, a map engraver misspelled Wisconsink River, which was already a mutated word, as Oricon Sint on a map. But because he ran out of room at the edge of the map, the Sint was placed below it. This very crowded map then showed the Oricon River flowing west from the Great Lakes region. And later, more fanciful maps applied the name to the fabled River of the West, which legend had flowing from the mid-continent through the Rocky Mountains to the Pacific Ocean. So Oricon passed into Oregon, Oregon, and finally into the name Oregon. Wyoming also began as an Eastern indigenous term that migrated west. The name of a valley in northeastern Pennsylvania, it might be a corruptive version of a Lenape word for the Big Flats or at the Big Flats or Great Meadows. But it became wildly popular after an 1809 poem, Gertrude of Wyoming, memorialized several hundred settlers killed by British loyalists and their allies. 10 Wyoming post offices sprang up between Rhode Island and Nebraska within decades. And the name was also proposed for a new territory organizing north of Colorado after the Civil War. And debates in both the U.S. House of Representatives and the Senate would prove to be the longest on the floor of Congress over land naming. Against the use of Wyoming was the obvious incongruity between name and place. Tribal names from the area were then considered, Cheyenne receiving the most attention, until one senator noted that it sounded too close to the French name for a female dog, Chien. And female dogs, as we know, are sometimes called a word that begins with B. So we know the end of the story. the reasons that won the day, euphony and poetic association, or as Wisconsin Senator James Doolittle offered, because it is a beautiful name. And so it is, one of my favorites in childhood to sing out loud. Wyoming Territory was established on July 25th, 1868. But what I'd like to turn to is a more difficult sense of naming. George Stewart, who wrote Names on the Land, one of the major works on naming in America, wrote this. In contrast to the oppressed Indian, the oppressed African left little mark upon the map. Pindertown in South Carolina preserved the Congo word Mpinda, meaning peanut. But white men probably did the naming after the word became current in local speech. Doubtless, many hundreds of small streams and swamps were named by Negroes, but their namings cannot be distinguished. Left little mark on the map, their namings cannot be distinguished. A dismissal unlikely to be questioned by most. But as diaspora linguists have observed, languages and naming patterns from Africa also cross the Atlantic, and toponyms bearing their influence survive on the land and on maps, especially in the coast and tidewater rivers of the South. These names are long forgotten, or the origins are, and that forgetfulness, of course, is part of the story. But a much more hurtful dimension lies in place names that refer to African Americans but were not given to them. Nigger, once featured in at least 200 official place names in this country. The U.S. Board on Geographic Names is the organization that is responsible for officially defining the name of a place. And if you look at their listing, you will find countless examples, such as Dead Nigger Creek, Dead Nigger Hill, Nigger Canyon, Nigger Slough, and the names go on and on. From Maine to Alaska, almost every single state, including New Hampshire. The NAACP petitioned the Board on Geographic Names for decades to remove this hateful word. And piecemeal changes occurred until 1963, when the board decided to replace what it called the pejorative form of Negro with Negro. But so embedded was the pejorative form that it still continues in pockets of local speech and on many maps. Look carefully when you travel across the country. Look at the maps and you'll see N-I-G-G-E-R still there. And other slur names remain, or they've only recently been changed by the U.S. Board. Chinks Peak in Pocatello, Idaho, just recently became Chinese Peak. Jap Rock in California was recently renamed Japanese Point. But many are still official names on the land. Picaninny Buttes in California, WAP Draw in Wyoming, Darkey Springs in Tennessee, Wetback Tank in New Mexico, Dago Gulch in Montana, Dead Injun Creek in many states, on and on. Words of enmity and ignorance that fell out of general favor long ago are still official names on the land. Names outlive the bestower for many reasons, and I think of the vantage point, the appearance of overwhelming overwhelming difference and distance in the eyes and ears of beholding namers over 500 years. Even the Linnaean system of binomial nomenclature listing genus and species that is so taken for granted as an international standard began as part of colonial world trade that collected human beings as it collected exotic plants and animals. and language spoken by unknown ancestors of different continents converge in me. But their linguistic tributaries, the ones arising in Africa and Native America, were cut off or diverted long ago. I write and speak in English, a language that has no adjective form for the word place. And my school rambles through Latin, French, and Castilian Spanish kept me mostly within Europe's realm. The sounds, the gestures, the rhythms from other lands were all lost. What lies beneath the surface of maps and names? The answers and their meanings, of course, depend on one's points of view, and whether what came before 1492 is considered prelude to an American story beginning to unfold, and whether participants from places other than Europe are seen as supporting casts or props, and whether we and our culture can embrace a much larger changing whole. So what I had hoped to do, if I had had just a few more minutes, was to read a little bit from the chapter on Washington, D.C., which speaks about the evolution of the city, a city that was established because the first president and others from Virginia, Thomas Jefferson and James Madison, among them, wanted the capital to be sited in a region that was not antagonistic to slavery. Philadelphia, which was the capital at that time after it had moved from New York, had recently passed a law that, an abolition law, that any enslaved people brought there would be free after several months. And so the nation's capital had to be sited where slavery would remain unmolested. And slavery remained unmolested there in the nation's capital until and even during the Civil War. And part of this is important because when I wrote Trace and wrote that chapter on DC, I did not know how deep ancestral roots grew in Chesapeake Earth. I didn't know how forebears were tied to the capital that would long condone chattel servitude, but also the trade of captive Africans within sight of Congress. Nor did I know how these ancestors were tied to the origin and settlement of colonial Virginia and Maryland, and to the commodification of lands for profit, primarily by tobacco. Nor did I know how they were tied to the development of slavery in this nation and to laws defining race, as well as to an emergent population of free people of color, several hundred thousand in 1860, many of them never enslaved, or if ancestors had been in the 1600s, were free by the end of the 1600s or early 1700s. This is my family. And what I also didn't know was this family included the blood of enslavers over multiple generations, as well as men who fought in the Revolutionary War. And in short, I didn't know how earlier lives were implicated in the origins of race and racism in this country. So the next book after Trace takes that exploration. So we didn't get to talk about Mexico, the border. I wish we had. We didn't talk about the appropriation of indigenous narratives to the early work in anthropology and ethnology here in this country by Henry Rowe Schoolcraft. We weren't able to consider other aspects that aren't often considered in American history that very much show that the past hasn't ended, and also show that this past alive today touches all of our lives, not just mine. So perhaps we can talk about it in our conversation, and thank you very much. Thank you. you.
Thank you, Lorette.